staying. I hope that we show the same resolute commitment when it comes to the Decade for Action and in the follow-up to this ICN2, this very important meeting and gathering. I thank you for staying because I think we have a very important message to convey, and I think that, you know, we hopefully all can, that we all share. By now, we have heard and are familiar with all the statistics around malnutrition, bringing into stark light the urgency for acting. I will not repeat those, but would like to focus on five central points that we believe are crucial in advancing our fight against the scourge of malnutrition. First, it is an imperative to tackle the social, cultural, and economic determinants of malnutrition in all its forms. As reminded by Pope Francis just this morning, the framing of any policy, program, and action plan on preventing and treating malnutrition must be the unambiguous understanding of the right to adequate food and nutrition as a fundamental human right, which identifies people as rights holders and states as duty bearers, with an obligation to respect, protect, and fulfil this right and related rights. Second, women are the primary agents of change in combating malnutrition in all its forms and must be at the core of its solution. As such, policies need to be instituted that empower women, including paid maternity leave, support for breastfeeding in the workplace, access to reproductive health services, addressing violence against women, access to land, credit and other productive resources, and universal social protection. Third, malnutrition in all its forms is the result of complex factors operating at different levels from the child, mother and family to the community level all the way up to the national and global level, including factors related to inequitable global power in many forms. At this moment, I would like to speak about the individual child and her mother. At the level of a child and mother, a number of underlying determinants exist that can lead to malnutrition. These include adequacy of the food in quantity and quality, the sufficiency of maternal and child care, and the adequacy of health services, including environmental sanitation. For a child, too little nutritious food combined with too much disease leads to stunted physical growth. I'd also like to emphasise that there is an important link between child undernutrition and the risk of developing non-communicable diseases later in life. But these consequences relate to those children that survive malnutrition. Many do not. So that we are all clear, improving malnutrition at the family level isn't just about producing more food. It's about producing more diversified, high-quality food containing essential micronutrients and ensuring that families have access to this food to meet their nutritional needs throughout the year for a healthy and productive life. This includes the protection of consumers through adequate regulations and laws against harmful and unethical marketing. As important as food, improving malnutrition also requires improving the care of women, especially their ability to adequately care and feed their children as well as themselves. Likewise, improving malnutrition also depends on there being quality universal health care, clean water and sanitation. So we must remember the critical importance of families of the three clusters of food, care and health when designing programmes aimed at improving nutrition during the 1,000-day window from conception to the second year of life. And as important, we cannot ignore the basic factors operating at deeper levels of society, some of which relate to unacceptable inequalities in society that influence the adequacy of these three critical underlying factors stated above. As I've just described, it is clear that the job cannot be left to just nutritionists or the health sector or just to the agriculture sector, but rather we need to put into place coordinated efforts across a number of sectors important for nutrition, including education, community development, macroeconomic planning, trade, infrastructure, among others. Fourth, We have much evidence today on what works, especially in the health sector, using nutrition-specific interventions targeting women and children, which can be promoted through community structures, including health and education. We need to support women to optimally breastfeed their babies from the first moments after birth up to 2 years of life or more. Protecting, promoting, and supporting breastfeeding is an essential tenet in saving infant lives and preventing malnutrition. Fifth, ICN2 is such an important step at this point in time to address this long overdue and morally unacceptable problem of malnutrition and its food, care, and health determinants. Strong and unwavering governmental and international commitment is needed, and it's needed now. We also need clear goals in our plans, including the World Health Assembly targets, which focus on reducing levels of stunting, wasting, breastfeeding anemia, low birth weight and overweight, and the WHO non-communicable disease targets. The WHO's specific indicators and benchmarks for each of these should be harnessed. Alongside this, we must put into place an effective and robust accountability process to track commitments and ensure that they are not just words on paper. Letting malnutrition slip from our radar would be ethically abhorrent. This is where the active and constructive participation of social movements and civil society organisations can be brought to bear to help in this monitoring, and we hope good progress. Lastly, building on the World Health Assembly nutrition and NCD targets within the post-2015 agenda will be critically important to ensure unwavering focus and that sufficient human and financial investments are made to achieve these goals and deliver a generation free of malnutrition in all its forms. Now let's go do it.